The Path of Compassion by G. de Brucker.
Page 54, Chapter 8, The Initiatory Cycle. The core of our being is pure consciousness, and in proportion as we ally ourselves with our inner God, with that pure monadic consciousness, shall knowledge come to us naturally. Our understanding will expand and finally become cosmic, and we shall then realize that there is another cosmos still grander, of which our cosmos is but an atom. This is the path of evolution, of growth, inner and outer. It is the pathway of initiation, the pathway to almighty love and compassion. The word initiation comes from a Latin root meaning to begin, and esoterically it connotes a new becoming, an entering upon a course of life and study, which eventually will bring out all of the spiritual and intellectual grandeur that the individual has within him. It is, in fact, a hastening of the evolutionary process, not in the sense of omitting any stage, but in condensing within a short period what in the natural course would take eons of striving to attain. Esoteric training, therefore, is often painful, for it means accelerated growth, doing rapidly and vigorously what in nature's ordinary procedures would take many, many tens of thousands of years, millions perhaps. It is painful at times because instead of slowly growing to see the beauty and harmony of life everywhere, one must learn to master oneself with an iron will, to forget oneself utterly, to serve all, to give up oneself for the universal self, to die daily so that one can live the cosmic life. I suppose that every human being takes it for granted that from the time he first issued forth from the bosom of the infinite as an unself-conscious God spark, until he reattains divinity as a self-conscious God, he will fail and fail many times, but that ultimately he will achieve if he rises and presses forwards. The failure is not so much. It is the going backwards, the stopping and allowing the evolutionary current to sweep by, leaving one in the rear. This is morally wrong. It is our duty to go forwards, to become impersonal, self-forgetful. Obviously, the expression going backwards does not imply an actual retrograde motion of a body. The idea is adapted from human experience. We may set out with high courage and leaping ambition to do something, and then discouragement overtakes us and we turn back, leaving the deed undone. Strictly speaking, going backwards is impossible, for nature closes the door behind us at every instant. Nor does it mean undoing what evolution has brought to pass. Rather, it denotes plunging farther into matter instead of rising more fully into spirit. In other words, changing the direction of our evolutionary journey. Never was there a Mahatma who had not failed and failed many, many times. Failure is unfortunate, but it can be remedied, and by the will of the strong turned into victory. To quote the words of William Q. Judge in Answers to Correspondents, September 1892, quote, "We may fail in specific acts or endeavor, but so long as we continue to persevere, such are not failures, but lessons necessary in themselves. Through resistance and effort, we acquire fresh strength. We gather to ourselves, and by occult laws, all the strength we have gained by overcoming. Entire success is not for us now, but continuous persistent effort is. And that is success, and not the mere carrying out of all our plans or attempts. Moreover, no matter how high we go in nature, there are always new rungs of the ladder to mount. That ladder whose rungs are all mounted in labor and in pain, but also in the great joy of conscious strength and will. Even the adept sees fresh trials before him. Remember also when we say, I have failed, it shows that we have had and still have aspiration. And while this is so, while we have before us loftier heights of perfection to scale, nature will never desert us. We are mounting and aspiring, and the sense of failure is the surest proof of this. But nature has no use for anyone who has reached the limits of or outlived his aspirations, so that every failure is a success. At the outset, the greater your aspirations, the greater the difficulties you will encounter. Forget not, then, that to continue to try, even when one constantly fails, is the only way to come to real success. End of quote. The aim of initiation is to ally the human being with the gods, which is begun by making the neophyte at one with his own inner god. It means not only an alliance with the divinities, but also that the initiant, the learner, if he succeed, will pass behind veil after veil, first of the material universe, and then of the other universes within the physical material one, each new passing behind a veil being the entering into a grander mystery. Briefly, it is the self-conscious becoming at one with the spiritual divine universe, enlarging the consciousness so that from being merely human, it takes unto itself cosmic reaches. The man in his thought and consciousness thus is at home in every part of universal being, as much at home on Sirius or on the polar star as he is on Canopus or on Earth, and even more so as regards the invisible worlds. Initiation is a quickening of the process of evolution, an enlivening of the inner man as contrasted with the outer physical person. In its higher stages, it brings with it powers and an unfolding of the consciousness which are verily godlike. But also does it imply the taking over unto oneself of godlike responsibilities. No one becomes an esotericist merely by signing a slip of paper. He cannot become such unless some gleam of Buddhic light shines in his heart and illumines his mind. A natural esotericist is one who is born with at least a glimmer of the Christ-like shining within. Such a one, sooner or later, as surely as the working of karma pursues its invariable course, is attracted to the path, for it is the working out of his destiny, trained and shaped in the past, into his character as it now is, and in its fruition blossoming forth into an instinctual recognition of truth. Footnote. There are occasional cases of individuals who have been chelas in past lives, but who have stumbled on the path and broken the link in some very unfortunate way for themselves with their teacher. Yet because of past excellencies, when the next or possibly a second incarnation occurs, they come into life endowed with unusual powers or faculties. They enter with a reservoir of garnered inner spiritual, intellectual, and psychical experiences, which give them light and help them to keep touch with the God within. HPB has called these the nurslings of the Nirmanakayas, and points to Jakob Böhme as an instance. There was an individual who, through some willfulness of a serious character, had broken the link, yet had advanced sufficiently far so that he did not lose the spiritual attainments he had made. Although no longer a direct chela, he was nevertheless watched over, aided, and his future progress gently stimulated, so that in the next life, or even at the end of the life he last lived as Jacob Böhme, he may again make or have made the conscious link. In other words, Böhme had spiritual experiences. He initiated himself from the fountain of light within himself, gained in former days when he was an accepted chela. In reality, as said, all initiation is self-initiation, self-awakening. A teacher merely guides, helps, comforts, stimulates, and supports. See The Secret Doctrine, Volume 1, page 494. End of footnote. The least and virtually negligible part of initiation is the ritual. No initiation can be conferred upon another. All growth, all spiritual illumination takes place within oneself. There is no other way. Symbolic rites and outer paraphernalia are but aids to the learner, aids to the developing of the power of the inner vision, the inner eye. Therefore, any initiatory trial, no matter where had or what the arrangements may be, is in essence an individual inner opening. Were it not so, there could be no initiation except as a hollow ritual, much as are the sacraments of the churches today for the most part. Even so, they are reflections, however faint, of one's living experiences of chelas undergoing initiation. The ancient mysteries of Greece, for example, those conducted by the state at Eleusis and Samothrace, or at Delphi, or again those which took place at the Oracle of Trophonius, were largely ceremonial. Yet in all of them, even in the degenerate days, there was also a certain amount of actual spiritual experience. I might add that the hints found in literature of the ordeals to be faced and overcome should not be construed too literally. They are not imaginary exactly, but are symbolic representations of what the initiant has to meet within himself. For thoughts are mental entities, and therefore have form and power of their own, and the individual must win over his lower nature or fail. There are actually 10 degrees in the initiatory cycle, but only the 7 that pertain to the 7 manifested planes of the solar system need concern us, the 3 highest being utterly beyond present human understanding, and they will remain so until our consciousness will have become virtually universal, ultra-human. These 7 degrees are the 7 great portals through which the pilgrim must pass before he attains quasi-divinity. Between each of these portals there are 7 smaller doors through which one must pass, each being a step in training, in schooling, so that all in all there are 49 stages, just as there are 49 planes in our solar system, 7 great planes, and 7 sub-planes, or minor spheres or kingdoms, in each of the primal 7. The first 3 grades or degrees are concerned with study, with unceasing aspiration to grow spiritually and intellectually, to evolve and become greater, and also with living the life. These are symbolic, that is, dramatic in form as far as the rites go. There is likewise teaching, which is the main part of these rites, about recondite secrets of nature, teaching which is rarely given in a reasoned and consecutive form because that is the brain-mind way, but suggested by a hint here, an allusion there. The method is not to fill the mind of the learner full of other men's thoughts, but to arouse the spiritual fire in himself which brings about an awakening of the understanding, so that in very truth the neophyte becomes his own initiator. What one receives from outside in the way of ideas, of thoughts, are merely the outward stimuli, arousing the inner vibration preparing for the reception of the light within. Transference of ideas is but a method of speaking. Impressions are made, which set up the corresponding vibratory cord in the recipient's psychological apparatus, and instantly the corresponding knowledge flashes from the recipient's own mind above. Devotion to truth, to the point of utterly forgetting oneself, opens the channel of reception. Light and knowledge then enter the mind and heart, from oneself, from one's inner God, which thus is awakened, or more correctly, begins to function, temporarily though it be. And it's in this wise that the man initiates himself. The whole process is based on nature's laws, on the natural growth of understanding, of interior vision. With the fourth initiation begins a new series of inner unfoldings. That is to say, not only are the study, the aspiration, and the living of the life continued in the future stages, but with this degree something new occurs. From that moment, the initiant starts to lose his personal humanity and to merge into divinity. That is, there ensues the beginning of the loss of the merely human and the commencing of the entering into the divine state. He is taught how to leave his physical body, how to leave his physical mind, and to advance into the great spaces, not alone of the physical universe, but more especially of the invisible realms as well. He then learns to become, to be, to enter into the intimate consciousness of the entities and spheres he contacts. The reason for this is that in order fully to know anything, one must be it. Temporarily, at least, one must become it. If he would understand precisely what it is in all its reaches, his consciousness must merge with the consciousness of the entity or thing which he is at that instant learning to know the meaning of. Hence, the quasi-mystical stories of the descent of the initiant into hell, in order to learn what the life of the hellions is, and what their sufferings are, and also partly in order to bring out the compassion of the one experiencing what these entities go through as the karmic result of their own misdeeds. And equally in the other direction, the initiant must learn how to become at one with the gods and to confer with them, to understand their nature and their life. He must for the time being himself become a god. In other words, enter into his own highest being. Thus, beginning with this fourth initiation, the neophyte slips into new realms of consciousness. The spiritual fires of the inner constitution are most potent, both in character and in functioning. The spiritual electricity, so to speak, flows with far more powerful current. One cannot really put these mystical things into everyday words. In addition to the teachings and the symbolic or dramatic ritual, the neophyte, and he is always such, no matter how high the degree may be, learns how to control nature's forces and become able to accomplish such wonders as consciously leaving the body, leaving our planet, in order to pass to other centers of the solar system. The fifth degree is along the same pathways of experience when the man becomes a master of wisdom and compassion. In this degree there comes the final choice, whether, like the great Buddhas of compassion, one will return to help the world, to live for it and not for self. or whether, like the Pratyeka Buddhas, one will go forwards on the pathway of self, merely self-development. The sixth initiation runs to still loftier realms of consciousness and experience, and then comes the last and supreme initiation, the seventh, which comprises the meeting face-to-face with one's divine self and the becoming at one with it. When this occurs, he needs no other teacher. It also includes individual communication with the Supreme Maha Chohan, who is practically identical with what has been called the silent watcher of the human race. Each degree stands on its own basis of rule and training. Nevertheless, the one rule runs through all, to wit, that the supreme guide for the neophyte is the God within himself, which is his final spiritual and intellectual tribunal, and in second order only comes his teacher. To such the disciple gives glad allegiance, but in no case blind obedience, for he knows by this time that his own inner God and the inner God of the teacher are both sparks of Alaya's self. I might add that the higher the degree, the more informal and less ritualistic become the relations between teacher and pupil, and the more is the pupil expected to strive to live in and to be at one with his inner divine monitor. Further, in the more advanced stages, no record of any kind is made. It is solely the memory of the auditors which is trained to receive and to retain what has been impressed upon it, a training which a dependence upon written notes could never bring about. Neither in writing, in paint, in cipher, nor in engraving are the teachings committed to visible record. They are carried in the mind and in the heart alone. The whole endeavor is to arouse the willpower, the individuality, and the native faculties of the inner God. The transmission of intelligence, therefore, passes at low breath and with mouth to ear, to use the old saying. In the highest degrees, not even this is permitted, for the neophyte, the recipient of esoteric knowledge and wisdom, has become so trained that he can receive by thought transference, as it were, and need not even be in the presence of his teacher. More and more the teacher communicates through the soundless sound, the voice of the silence, the voice in which the teachings, uttered, opens the spiritual vistas within the disciple. Every step forwards is a going into a greater light, in comparison with which the light just left is shadow. No matter how high one stands on the ladder of evolution, even as high as the gods, there is always one other just ahead, one who knows more than he, and ahead of him there is a constantly ascending range of entities of progressively vaster cosmic consciousness. The hierarchical stream is nature's basic framework. Hence, none of us is without a teacher, for there is the infinite universe above us. Hierarchies of life and of evolutionary experience far superior to ours. Consequently, when the monadic essence of a man, after leaving our own hierarchy, advances into the sublimer realms of cosmic being, he does so as an embryo entity, therein beginning his next upward climb on the first round of that new ladder of life, when perforce he will need someone to guide his steps. And that need for guides and teachers will remain until in the course of the cycling ages he will have climbed higher and higher to the topmost rung of that ladder of life, when again he shall become at one with that still sublimer mystery of the inmost of his being. And to this sublimer mystery, what name can we give? Human language fails, and only the spiritual imagination can soar into the spheres of the divine. Thus the evolving entity passes continually from one to another range of life, from one to another hierarchy of ineffable experience, and thus forwards forever. Is it not self-evident that one is always a learner in the school of life? For there are veils upon veils covering the face of eternal reality. When once the spiritual understanding has come, forgetfulness can never thereafter ensue. It is precisely in the inability to wipe out from the memory the glory seen and almost touched that lies the wretchedness of failure undergone by the unsuccessful aspirant. He who has never experienced heaven yearns toward it, and with hope of success, whereas he who has skirted its boundaries and had a glimpse of the supernal through its portals and then fails to pass within, will remember enough to fill his soul with agony and even despair at the remembrance of the vision seen and lost. When it comes to the severe tests, terrific as they are in the more advanced degrees, the mentality must be such that it will repel outside influences of the most persuasive character. Such influences arise in impressionability, at once a great virtue, but in many respects a fatal weakness. And another psychological factor to be carefully watched is the too strong and too quick logical faculty of the brain-mind. The mentality must be rigidly subordinated to the nobler attributes and not usurp the place of mastery. If it is made subservient, then it is of genuine value. The higher mind, rooted in the Bodhi principle, has an infallible logic as well as an infallible intuition of its own, of which the brain-mind procedures are pale and usually distorted reflections, and because of this are often most dangerous enemies. One cannot trifle with occultism with impunity. The entire nature is aroused, and the battle with the lower self at times may take on the character of desperation, for the neophyte instinctively feels that he must conquer or fail. But if he perform faithfully the first duty that comes to hand, no matter how humble and simple, that is his path. In conquering our own weaknesses, we help not only our own nature, but all mankind. More, we help every sentient living thing, for we are at one with the very forces which are the circulations of the universe. To achieve the bond of union with one's essential self is the supreme aim of initiation. Footnote. For some reason, there has been a singular misapprehension among a few to the effect that the highest initiations are denied to women. This is not the case. There is nothing in the world that prevents a woman from reaching the noblest pinnacle of attainment, from passing successfully the most severe tests of initiation. However, those who take the highest initiations usually do so in a man's body simply because it's easier, the psychological and physiological apparatuses being better prepared for passing those initiations. But it's downright foolish to suppose that initiation in any age, past or present, has been or is the prerogative or a special privilege of men. One has but to recall the long and uninterrupted line of prophetesses, even in the anthropomorphic and materialistic civilizations of historic Greece and Rome, to realize that women had their place in the temple schools and achieved high and outstanding honors in the esoteric training. The oracle at Delphi is perhaps the most widely known. Other examples are the Celtic Druids and Germanic peoples, who were famous in antiquity for their women leaders, their seeresses and prophetesses. However much women initiates may have kept behind the veil of seclusion, their inner capacity and power to achieve were universally recognized. End of footnote. It is the pathway to the gods, which means making of each one of us an individual divinity. The following of this pathway is a most serious, a most sacred undertaking. It will call forth every particle of strength, of willpower, that one's nature contains, if one wishes to go forward to the sublime ultimate. How to achieve this is by totally ignoring the knot of personality, thus passing into the smooth orbital movement of consciousness existing around the central core of one's being, and then finally to blend and become at one with the sublime wonder, the divinity within. Behind every veil there is another, but through them all shines the light of truth, the light that liveth forever within every one of us, for it is our inmost self. Every human being in the core of his essence is a sun, destined to become one of the starry hosts in the spaces of space, so that even from the very first instant when the divine spiritual part of us begins its peregrinations through universal being, it is already a sun in embryo, a child of some other sun that then existed in space. Initiation brings forth this inner, latent, stellar energy in the heart of the neophyte. Aham asmi parabrahman. I am the boundless all, beyond both space and time. This idea is the very keystone of the temple of ancient truth. It is Mother Nature in her divine, spiritual, psychological, ethereal, and physical reaches that is our universal home, a home having no specific location because it is everywhere. Here, then, is the pathway by which any son of man may ascend, if he have the inflexible will to do so and the yearning for a greater light. He may rise along the different stages of the hierarchy, taking each step upwards through an initiation, until his being finally becomes at one with the silent watcher of our globe. Then, at a period still more distant, his monad will become at one with the silent watcher of our planetary chain. And at a period still more remote in cosmic time, he will become identified as an individual monadic life center with the hierarch of our solar universe. The inmost of us is the inmost of the universe. Every essence, every energy, every power, every faculty that is in the boundless all is in each one of us, active or latent. All the great sages have taught the same verity, man, know thyself, which means going inwards in thought and feeling, in ever greater measure allying ourselves self-consciously with the divinity at the core of our being, the divinity which also is the very heart of the universe. There indeed is our home, boundless, frontierless space.